This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch, grass-fed beef raised on California's Central Coast. Now available online through Larder Meat Company. Learn more at HearstRanch.com.
Hello, and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. On today's episode, we return to our annual trend show with Michael Whiteman. As the vaccine gets widely distributed, he looks forward to tell us what's going to be happening in the food world, what will stay, what will be changed forever, and why having less restaurants might just be a good thing. On today's episode, I'm also joined by my wonderful co-host and longtime brother, Darren Bresnitz, as we interview Michael together. So sit back, relax, and here's another episode of Snacky Tunes on HRN.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Greg Bresnitz.
I'm the other half your host, Darren Bresnitz. Michael, so good to see you.
Hello again.
Michael, I think this is our ninth trend show with you. And you know, we took last year off, and wouldn't you know it, you take 1 year off and the whole world falls apart. So
I thought you were just ignoring me on purpose because you were getting bored.
No, never. But COVID has saved us from the question of how did we do last year? Because nothing works. And I think, like, for any of you who have not had the pleasure of listening to this, we do an annual trend show with Michael. You can go to Baum and Whiteman and you can get their trend report. If you want to read ahead, please do so. If you want to go back and check old predictions, please do so. Or listen to old episodes, you can. Why don't we just start at the beginning and just say, you know, writing a trend report at the beginning of the end of the pandemic is interesting. So what went into your mindset and how do you think dining is going to be different this year and in the following years?
Well, first of all, writing a trend report at the end of the beginning of COVID is better than writing a trend report at the end of the end. So it wasn't quite a religious experience. The whole world is turned upside down, as you know. Some of us have even moved from New York to places like Louisiana for some unexplained reason. And the rest of us have been looking out our windows and not doing a hell of a lot of anything except eating, drinking, and largely having a good time. What's happened is that consumers have changed their behavior quite a bit, as you would imagine, because they're locked in at home. And they're not where they would normally be, which is to say they're not in their offices, they're not on vacation, they're not in college, and they're not, for the most part, feeling free. But how they've behaved at home has changed rather dramatically because, number one, they've rediscovered the joys and pleasures of sitting around the dinner table together. We're no longer leading the fractured lives that we used to live where you ate at one time and I ate at another time and the kids ate at a third time and half of the occasions weren't at home at all. Now we're eating home more. We're eating with our families. Who knows? We might like to get to like each other again. And we're cooking at home far more frequently and enjoying it. People are getting into cooking. They're getting into exploring new recipes. They're getting into exploring a lot new ethnic foods that they're learning to cook at home or they're ordering in. And getting a taste of the flavor and then deciding that they'd like to cook at home. There's an interesting group of statistics. At the end of 2019, 75% of all of the eating and drinking occasions in our country took place in the home. 75%. That means 25% were eaten somewhere else. At the end of 2020, the number jumped to 83%. Now you may say to go from 75 to 83 doesn't sound like it's an earth-shaking leap, but if you multiply it by the number of eating occasions in the country, you get hundreds and hundreds of meals, millions of meals that have been transferred from eating out to eating home. Will that continue after COVID? Oh, the numbers will come down again, but they won't come down to where they were for quite some time, if maybe ever, because we've learned to enjoy standing by the stove and stirring and cooking and eating new food. So I think there's a permanent change there, that all happens at the expense of restaurants, of course.
Let's talk about those restaurants, because I think there is a huge understanding of the restaurant industry that happened in the last year for people who may have never thought about labor costs or where people get paid or inequality and the amount of restaurants and how prices are not really sustainable, how the federal, you know, how the independent restaurant, was it really organized into a cohesive type of union or membership before the bottom fell out, despite many people in the industry saying the bottom's been gone for years. So what do you think is going to happen with, and I'll say the independent restaurant industry, not the big chains or things like that, in the next year or so? And while a lot have already fallen, some estimate 100,000 restaurants, for those that survive, for those that intentionally or not were set up for a COVID-like situation, how do they come out on the other side better, stronger? You know, what is going out to eat look like when we get out of the pandemic?
You just asked a very complicated question that requires a whole group of answers. I'm going to be long-winded until you interrupt me.
That's fine. I mean, it's perfect. I think understanding the complications of it is really important, because it is going to dictate probably the rest of our conversation.
Okay. So we know that a couple of 100,000 restaurants have gone out of business in the last year. That doesn't mean that in short order the country will be missing all those restaurants, because the ownership of the restaurants went out of business and disappeared, but the facilities remain. So as the economy improves, and it's happening right now, by the way, as the economy improves, various entrepreneurs who have access to cash and capital will reopen those restaurants with another concept and another name and another ownership. So we're not going to lose all of those restaurants. We just will lose the entrepreneurs who owned them in the first place. So there's a mortality of people, but not necessarily a mortality of all of the restaurants. Last year was a perfect storm. Or an imperfect storm, if you wish, for the restaurant industry, because all the chickens came home to roost. It's been a tenuous business, especially for independent operators, for many years. There have been too many restaurants opening, chasing not enough customers. And as a result of that, the independent operators have been hanging by a thread in the first place. On top of that, there has been, as a result of the election last year, there has been increased focus on inequality. And the restaurant industry is one of those places where inequality is extremely rampant. Owners, in theory, make a lot of money. Waiters and waitresses, in theory, make a good living, and if they're working at a good restaurant, indeed they do. And the people who do the grunt work in the back of the house, work for, let's say, sub-poverty wages. In some parts of the country, if you're a waitress in Louisiana, you probably get $2.13 an hour right now for waiting on tables. And if it rains tonight, all you've got is the $2.13 per hour, unless and then you get it for an 8-hour shift unless you're sent home early. So the people who are working in restaurants are more tenuous in their lives than people who own them. And the people who are working in the back of the house, who don't get tips, who only work for minimum wage largely, are primarily people of color. People who work in the front of the house and get tips and make fairly decent wages are not people of color. That recognition has suddenly bubbled up to the surface because of Black Lives Matter, because of the rampant levels of discrimination and foul language that came from, as Joe Biden calls, the other guy. So it's become a big social issue, and people who are going out to eat are reading all about the plight, not just of the restaurateurs, but of the plight of the workers there. We will end up with fewer restaurants, and I think that's a good thing.
And I want to just to say on that, over the years, you have talked about the cannibalization of restaurants. So when Fred Siegel opened up a restaurant inside of their shopping center, or the uprising of fast casual. And you've been ringing this bell for years that there's just too many restaurants, that just it's not sustainable. Although it's not popular to be championing that in any means, because that's someone's investment in livelihood. You do go on to say that fewer restaurants is a good thing. Why is that?
It's a good thing for several reasons. Number one, it's restaurants are going to be put out of business because minimum wages are going to go up. Restaurants have been surviving, and by the way, people in the restaurant industry hate me for saying this. Restaurants, both large and small, have been existing in this country because of the government subsidy, and it's an invisible government subsidy. That waitress who makes $2.13 an hour is probably on welfare. Probably her family is on welfare. The dishwasher in the kitchen who's making $7.50 an hour is also on welfare. And all of these transfer payments from the government to people who are making minimum wage, which is really sub-poverty wage, in the form of welfare payments, these transfer payments are a subsidy to the restaurant industry. If restaurants charged what they should be charging for, say, a hamburger based on the cost, real cost of the labor, which is what the restaurant is paying now, plus what the government pays the worker, then an $8 hamburger might be a $15 hamburger. That would be the real price. Now, depending on your politics, you can say, well, it's okay that the government subsidizes it because these people have a job. The other is that you're paying, when you go to a restaurant, a hidden tax that you're not aware of. And you might not be paying it so willingly if you knew that you could pay that same number rather as a tax to the government, to the employer of the underpaid employee. So if you raise prices to what they should be, you may diminish the number of people who go out to eat. And if you diminish the number of people who go out to eat, then of course you'll have fewer restaurants. Who loses? Independent restaurants largely, but restaurant chains as well. If we watched dozens of chains go Chapter 11 or Chapter 7 in the last year, and not small ones either. So the people who are on the edge economically will disappear. The rest of the restaurant industry, one hopes, will be more efficient. Does that answer your question?
it's great. It's such a unbelievable mind melt to think about that my burger is subsidized by welfare. One of the interesting untetherings of these restaurants closing is chefs and chefs as brands, and them finding alternative revenue streams. One of the things that Darren wanted to discuss was about the rise of that.
The notion of chefs being cut loose from their restaurants is having a big effect. And I'd like to talk about the positive side of that rather than the negative side of that, the negative side being that you have chefs who are out of work. The positive side is that the whole community of chefs, not just in this country, but around the world, has expanded and become emotionally a lot more connective and supportive. So out-of-work chefs are being given gigs in other people's restaurants, A, in order to keep them busy, and B, so the other restaurants can have reasons to promote themselves so that customers will come and eat, even if it's just sitting outside, or get on their smartphones and order this chef's food to be delivered. So restaurants are becoming hosts to out-of-work chefs. Large number of out-of-work chefs and cooks and who used to work in restaurants are actually working from their homes. And they have found a community of people via Instagram and via the internet. And they may only be cooking one item out of their kitchen or two or three items out of their kitchen, and they may only be cooking 50 portions a day. But they've found the constituency that I think will continue with them as a matter of loyalty if they like their food. We're seeing a lot of other kinds of collaborations. For example, and I really like this one. It's an example of others, but it's a good one. We have in Brooklyn here basically it's a website that allows people to buy soup in a mason jar. The soup can come from restaurant A, and it comes packaged with a loaf of fancy bread from bakery B, and the package is delivered to a wine or liquor store near where you live, where you can pick it up. You've prepaid for it, so the package is there waiting for you, and if it all works well, you'll buy a bottle of wine. So now we have three entities that used to be three separate businesses who are now collaborating together and forming a kind of community. I think that's a wonderful thing that probably will continue in some form or another. There's a bar in San Francisco that is not able to open because you can't sit in the bar. And you're not allowed to deliver, as of last month you weren't, now you are, booze to the street without meals. And here's a bar that only is a bar and doesn't have any food. But there's a breakfast place next door. It's open for breakfast and lunch. And they've collaborated on a common outdoor seating. And you can order Eggs Benedict or steak and eggs from the diner coffee shop. Or if you want to, you can order a cocktail from the cocktail bar place if you order the food. So there's synergy here of two separate businesses combining to increase both of theirs. And we're seeing lots of examples like this going on around the world. It's very heartening.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. The Hearst family has raised cattle on California's Central Coast since 1865. Today, Hearst Ranch's signature product is their 100% grass-fed, completely hormone and antibiotic-free beef. The Hearst Ranches have always treated their animals with great care. Their cattle live a completely natural existence as foragers and grazers. Well-managed grazing fertilizes the land naturally, sustains a seasonal rhythm to the ranches, and produces a remarkable meat whose flavor is the authentic taste of the American West. Hearst Ranch beef is available seasonally, May through August, in select Whole Food markets throughout California, and all year round at their retail locations in San Simeon and Paso Robles. And now, HRN listeners in Arizona, Nevada, and California can get Hearst Ranch beef delivered right to their door through Larder Meat Company. Go to lardermeatco.com and shop the 100% grass-fed box to stock your freezer with Hearst Ranch beef. That's LARDER meatco.com. Learn more about the storied history, farming practices, and conservation efforts of Hearst Ranch at hearstranch.com.
Are you longing for a trip to Mexico? Do you want to taste mezcal straight out of a wood-fired clay pot still at a palenque in Puebla? Well, we can't help you with that, but we can offer the next best thing, agave road trip in a box. This set of 10 samples of rare heritage agave spirits will transport your heart with the warmth of liquid Mexico. Get your set at agavefestival.org and then join Agave Road Trip podcast co-hosts Chava and me, Lou, for an online tasting. agavefestival.org. Is the break you've been looking for, or as close as you're going to get.
You know, I want to go back to what you said about chefs as brands and connecting directly with people at home, because especially in Los Angeles, I've seen a lot of chefs either lose or leave a line cook position or part of a restaurant that can no longer sustain them, and then open up their own pop-up or going to a commissary, inspired more by their personal story and their, you know, their more personal cooking roots. I think of someone like a chef, Rashida Holmes, who wound up losing her cooking job, but then opened up Bridgetown Roadie and is cooking Bahamian flavors, you know, from her family. But I think you're seeing a new spin on what happened in 2009 with the rise of the food truck, right? Which is a lower bar to entry, but a more personal connection. But also the tale as old as time, cooking the food from your family, what you know, to survive.
Let's call them all pop-ups for the moment.
Sure. Let's call them pop-ups. As a good allegory to the 2009 food truck. We'll call them pop-ups.
Correct. They're pop-ups without food trucks, and a food truck is a fairly expensive piece of equipment. And if you don't have money in the time of COVID, you don't start a food truck.
Which is funny, because back when those started, those were seen as the cheap options, but now the food truck game has leveled up so much. You still need six figures to get in.
Correct. So chefs who are out of work are, as I said earlier, popping up in other people's restaurants. They're popping up in farmers markets. They're popping up on street corners with outdoor barbecues. They're popping up in front of, for example, the one I just gave you in San Francisco. They're popping up in front of bars that, or in the backyard of a bar that doesn't have food, so that they can earn a living. And some of these pop-ups are evolving into full-time gigs at real restaurants, where, to cite a simple example, somebody who cooks great breakfasts might find a restaurant that's open for lunch and dinner that has spare capacity in the kitchen in the morning, and they take over the kitchen and have a breakfast restaurant. And now you're getting two restaurants in the same location sharing costs. That again goes back to my idea of building community. And by the way, there's a fair amount of this going on. I just looked at one in London where somebody is taking over a restaurant in the morning and just making bagels.
I love it. I'll go there.
Yeah, and then she folds her tent in mid-morning, and the restaurant takes over its kitchen and does all its prep for lunch and dinner. So some people are finding permanent places. Let's call them kitchens within kitchens. Some people are discovering that their pop-ups are successful enough that they can move into a vacant brick-and-mortar restaurant where a landlord is willing to make a deal in order to get somebody into a vacant space. And some people are cooking, as you said, their ethnic cuisine from their own kitchens. And they start out selling to people in their own families and then their own communities. And then word gets around and you order on Instagram or on your smartphone. And these people are now have a business out of their kitchen. In recent years, that's been mostly illegal in most states. And that has been relaxed for COVID so that people can earn a living. And I think those rules will probably loosen in the future and stay loose. So we're seeing lots of inventive ways for chefs to produce their food.
Yeah, you know, a lot of other restaurants that are tapping into a cultural movement are coming out of, you know, what happened with George Floyd and Black Lives Matter movement, and you're seeing a real rebalancing, an important one, of seeing more African and Afro-American cooking and Black chefs getting their due that is long overdue. And you've seen that with both programming on TV, restaurants that have been opening, but also a conversation and examining, you know, what sometimes people think is a monolithic culture of food is extremely diverse, extremely important. And if you really dig deep, has really shaped American cuisine. Can you talk a little bit about the important shifting focus on the chefs and the movement behind this?
Sure. Is also part of that perfect storm of COVID last year and the recognition of inequality and the rise of Black Lives Matter. And I have to say the rise of Black Lives Matter has been a galvanizing movement, again, thanks to the former guy in the White House who tugged at the liberal heartstrings of the country into recognizing that there's been this level of inequality for so long. And so there's been a big swelling of publicity in support of Black chefs. Largely, we haven't recognized that how many Black chefs there are because they haven't had their own restaurants, and they haven't had their own restaurants for all the reasons of inequality that we know, including the difficulty of getting financing, which would probably be at the top of the list. So they're now getting both an increase in visibility and an increase in financial support. You see all of the food and beverage websites in municipalities around the country now listing restaurants that are owned by Black chefs, or restaurants where Black chefs are cooking, or where a Black chef is the sommelier. Where a restaurant has a Black sommelier. This is something that hasn't been recognized and now is being hyper-recognized, if you want to use that word.
Along with a number of the trends and changes, I think with people picking up home cooking, and I'm speaking for my own experience, is a new war on waste, which you discuss, and the idea of how I used to go out to eat, all the plastic and all the garbage that came with it, leftovers, etc. And now that we are stuck at home and have gotten into menu planning, it's just been like, wow, I really don't think those habits are going to go back to that. What have you seen both in home cooking trends, but also how does it apply to restaurants? They're already doing economizing on space with the morning restaurant concept and our afternoon concept. But where are you seeing on how they're tackling this ongoing problem?
You mean the war on waste problem?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's another thing that came to the fore during COVID, isn't it? The reason it came to the fore during COVID is that we all increased the amount of food that we order in, and we increased it radically. And with that comes, as we all know, an excess of packaging, of packages, within boxes, with all kinds of throwaways that are clogging up our garbage and creating an ecological mess. And so there's only now really beginning to be a movement among the people who create packaging for how to diminish all of the superfluous stuff that gets sent to your house every time you order something in. Will it go away? No, it won't go away. It can be diminished by quite a bit. What the utensils and what the dishes are made of is now under great scrutiny, because some of it lasts for an infinite number of years. Some of it says it's recyclable, but it's only recyclable if it's recycled, and usually it just goes in the garbage pail. I think in the years ahead, because of the awareness of how much gets thrown away in this country, you will see a greater attention on the part of manufacturers to minimize waste. There's been at the same time an attack, or at least an awareness, on the amount of food that we throw away. It's been estimated that somewhere between a third and a half of the food that's grown in this country never makes it to the dinner plate for one reason or another, whether it's because it's left in the field because the prices aren't high enough, or because the government subsidizes the use of corn so we can burn it in our fuel tanks instead of eat it, or because we're just generally profligate and throw food away when we don't have to. I think people who've been cooking at home during COVID, who've been aware of how much things cost suddenly, are also paying more attention to what they used to throw away because it was a little brown or a little limp, or it looked like a leftover and our house doesn't have leftovers. Well, now they're using leftover food to make leftovers. Mm-hmm. So I think in a way we've become more efficient, and I think that that provides a level of self-gratification.
Getting back to self-exploration, thinking about expanded flavor profiles, for so many people who have now coming up, been putting up maybe, you know, anywhere from 15 to 18 to 21 meals a week in their own kitchen. It was interesting to see that you are talking about global flavors of the world starting to get into people's kitchens and then becoming more standard. Where something like living in Southern California, tagine is something that's a little bit more familiar to me, and same with like a chili crunch. But, yes, you know, jerk seasoning or berbere, which is this incredible Ethiopian spice. Why are people reaching for these types of flavors? And are they here to stay, or are they just of the moment?
No, they're not of the moment. It used to be when you went shopping in the supermarket for spices, the spices were arranged alphabetically, and they started with an anise, and they ended up with something with a Z. So you got a bottle of a little jar of tarragon, or a jar of cumin, or a large thing of black pepper, or a jar of coriander. The people who cook around the world very rarely use just those spices one at a time. They usually use in conjunction with other spices. For example, we think of curry as something that comes from a jar and looks yellow. That curry powder is made up of anywhere between 6 and 12 different other spices that have been roasted, ground, and combined according to each person's individual recipe or each company's recipe, which is why no two curries taste alike. So curry powder is something that we also reach for on the shelf next to the cumin, which, by the way, is one of the spices in the curry powder. The more we have been eating home, the more ethnic food we've been eating, because we just demand the variety. And so we're learning to understand what those flavors are, but not how to make them. And most ethnic food, Indian, Chinese, Mexican, if it's real Mexican, it's fairly complicated. The list of ingredients goes on, if you look at a recipe, forever. But if you want your chicken to taste Mexican, and you're just roasting a chicken tonight, you can buy from a high-quality spice maker a bottle of berbere, as you called it, if you're Ethiopian. And it's got chilies and cardamom and cinnamon and ginger and nutmeg and allspice and coriander in it. You could make it at home. In fact, the New York Times ran up a piece just last week about these spice mixtures you can make at home. But for those of us who like to stay sane, we can buy high quality spice mixes like berbere, like tahine, as you said. For the listeners who don't happen to live in California, it's a mixture of dehydrated lime and chili peppers and sea salt, and sometimes with sugar. You can rub it on fish. You can dip your cocktail glass in it and make a margarita. It's great sprinkled on fruit, and it's got a big citrusy, spicy kind of overtone.
It's perfect.
And so there's za'atar from Israel and Lebanon and Syria. There's douka from Egypt, which is wonderful. It's a mix of ground sesame seeds and nuts. Oh, by the way, and cumin, coriander, and fennel, which, by the way, also are in curry powder. We're now seeing these spice mixtures available, and they're showing up on shelves at home. I have to say that when you see them in a supermarket, you're likely to find that the first ingredient is salt, and the second ingredient is pepper. So you're not really getting value for money. But there are, and you can go online and see them, there are really good spice mixers who are selling online. And you can use them either to make an authentic dish, or you can use it just to flavor your own. You know, if you want your If you want your hamburger to taste Korean tonight, you can buy, in this case, it would be a liquid, but you can buy liquid Korean seasoning mixes and sprinkle them on your hamburger, and suddenly you've got a whole new dimension.
So we want to make sure that we get to the buzzwords, probably our favorite section. I want to start with the stay-at-homers opting for better coffees. I am beyond guilty of getting into pour-overs and like taking the time to actually learn it. You talk about better paraphernalia. What tips do you have for me on to up my homebrewing game?
Well, if you want to really get into it, you would buy green coffee beans and roast your own. You could do that at home. You have to spend some time learning how, and you'd probably burn a lot of beans until you did. And your kitchen would smell a bit. But if that's what you really wanted to do and get really into coffee, you'd buy green coffee beans, which you can buy on mail order, and roast them. You can buy a small roaster, on the web. If you didn't want to do that, then you would buy whole beans from somebody who you trust. And it might be somebody who roasts them locally, and you might be able to walk down or drive to the place and pick up freshly roasted beans. And then grind the beans one portion at a time. So, and you would have to figure out how many beans make a portion for you. And you would weigh them out in milligrams. You would have a high quality grinder, and then you would get a filter coffee like a Chemex or a Melitta filter, and you would get the water to exactly the right temperature, which is somewhere below boiling, by the way, and you would spend a lot of time pouring little dribs and drabs of water into the coffee grounds until you got yourself a cup of freshly ground, freshly brewed coffee that, if you didn't have it on a warm surface, would be tepid. So that's the process. Are you willing to do that? Is that what you're trying to do?
I don't think anyone is. No.
I mean, we can try. All right, Darren, what buzzword do you have?
Well, I live really close to the San Gabriel Valley out here, and I'm a huge fan of steamed rice noodle wraps, which I was excited to see on the trends for next year. Where are these popping up, and why are they becoming more important?
These rice noodle wraps that you make reference to are steamed. So they're soft and floppy. They're not like a burrito wrap that, or a tortilla wrap that we're used to thinking of. They have a different texture and a different set of flavors. They're gluten-free, so people have an attraction to them. And they're popping up where there are large Asian communities. Mm. San Gabriel, you know, is Asian community from one end to the other. They're popping up in New York as well. They're good as a snack. You can put it on a plastic plate and walk around with a fork and eat it. They're good eaten on a plate with a knife and fork and sitting down. And they hold up under delivery conditions. So and what goes into the wrap is up to the person who's selling it. So it's another way of having an adventure and finding a whole other new dimension of Chinese cuisine.
You're also starting to see things like chickpeas or other high protein vegetables pop up in unexpected places. As people start to re-examine their relationship with meat and where they get their protein, can we expect to see, you know, chocolate with chickpeas or other things that are sneaking in protein in unexpected places?
The answer to that question is yes. That's the short answer. The longer answer is something more complex. And it has to do with people gravitating towards plant-based foods, which sounds like a good thing. Well, you know, we'll kill fewer cows and there'll be far less cow farts polluting the atmosphere. You know, cows have a lot to do with global warming. So, you know, it all sounds very good and we'll live on plants. The issue here is that these plant-based foods, which are largely made of chickpeas and soybeans these days, are highly processed. We don't really know that they're better for you. In fact, we don't know that they're good for you at all. But we certainly don't know that they're better for you than something that used to walk on four legs. In addition to that, the increasing use, let's use chickpeas as a whipping person. Can't call it a whipping boy anymore. as a whipping person. Chickpeas, you know, we used to seeing them in hummus, and we used to seeing them in, but they're now, if you go to the supermarket, see the chickpea pasta, and you'll find them in all kinds of plant-based foods. It sounds good until you realize that the increasing demand for chickpeas suddenly makes it a great big agribusiness. And so you now have this vision in your head of miles and miles and rows of chickpeas being sprayed with insecticides and artificial fertilizers and being harvested in order to make this plant-based foods that's supposed to be better for you and save the earth. It's not clear that it does. And this whole business needs to be investigated. But in the meantime, yes, a lot more chickpeas and a lot more plant-based foods.
Well, Michael, we want to thank you for another wonderful trend report. Again, not easy to write in the face of uncertainty, but there's so much more in here that we didn't get to like every year. Where can people go and find and read it and check out last year's report and contact you for deeper insights and possibly their own report? How do people find you?
You go to, there's a couple of ways. You can go to Michael Whiteman and trends in Google, and you'll find me. The other is you can search for our company, which is Baum, B-A-U-M, whiteman.com. And that will take you to our website where there's more about trends than you'll ever want to know.
Amazing. Well, listen, we want to thank you so much for being a part of this and for coming back. And we promise we will never take a year off again, because obviously we did and look what happened, and we just can't afford to do it at all. So
no, the world depends on you guys.
Yeah, well, we depend on you to tell us what we can expect and, you know, where we can buy our futures on different food products. So now I need to go call my broker for rice and chickpeas and cumin and things like that. But listen, thank you so much. Hopefully we'll be eating pizza again together very soon. And, you know, I look forward to seeing where we are a year from now with food restaurants. To be honest, I would be happy just to be eating out at this point. Listen, thank you again.
I think we all will. We all hunger for company.
Yes, we do. We're going to tag out a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes. Greg, always a pleasure. Kong, thank you so much. Jeet, the whole network. We'll see you next week. Have a good Sunday.
You can feel it in the morning. production.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.